We begin the hour by welcoming to the program a talented journalist. He's the NFL senior writer at Anscape, an ESPN platform, an expert in the NFL, and has written for ESPN.com as a columnist, as well as the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and ESPN, the magazine. He's the author of a terrific new book, Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America. Jason Reed joining us on Downtown.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Appreciate you being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, what a wonderful book. It's a terrific look at, I think, an important issue, not just in sports, but here in America. And I like the way you've set the book up in starting with 2019. Can you explain why that was such a big year for the NFL and for black quarterbacks in particular?
Yeah, quarterback is the most important position in team sports. And there had never been more superstar black quarterbacks playing in the league. And going into that year, I thought that these guys may have unprecedented seasons, and they did. And it was the 100th season anniversary of the NFL. And to have these black players, these black quarterbacks, excel like they had never excelled before, this group that had been so marginalized throughout league history, I thought that the symbolism of that was really important.
The book is so well-researched, and I learned an awful lot. I knew very little of the story of Fritz Pollard Sr. Can you talk a bit about him?
Yeah, Fritz Pollard was actually the first black superstar, black quarterback, and black coach in NFL history. He entered the league, you know, during its founding, when it was in its infancy, and he was a superstar. He had a great rivalry with the great Native American athlete Jim Thorpe, who was the star of the 1912 Olympics. And Jim Thorpe, you know, was one of the early pioneers of the NFL. And Fritz Pollard endured so much racism, endured so much just hardship as a pioneer in the game. You know, the first black star, first black head coach, and first black quarterback. He lined up at quarterback. It's not quarterback as we know it today, but still, he was the first one. And just to see how he persevered and then the path that he lit for others, it was truly inspiring to me while I was researching and reporting the book.
And I was also surprised to see that one of his teammates for a while was the great Paul Robeson.
Yeah, Paul Robeson and Fritz Pollard, they were friends. They were friends in college. Robeson attended Rutgers, and Fritz Pollard attended Brown, and they were both stars in college, and they were friends. And, you know, Robeson, I don't know if a lot of people know that Paul Robeson, the great actor and singer, he also was an NFL player at one point, and he was a college football star.
Why did the NFL enact their ban on black players?
Well, you know, there's no written documentation, or at least no written documentation has been uncovered explaining what the thinking was. From what we know, it looks like it was just a so-called gentleman's agreement. And you got to remember, it was the 1930s, the Depression, and, you know, the Great Depression in America. And the feeling was that, well, why are we taking these jobs and giving them to black men? We're giving them to white men. Also, the league wanted to get away from black players. Red Grange, the great star at Illinois, came into the league, and the league wanted to market the game toward white people. They really didn't want to court black fans. So the combination of the Depression, the Great Depression, the emergence of Red Grange, you see black players disappear from the game for 12 years.
And what role did Paul Brown play in reintegrating professional football?
Well, Paul Brown is such an innovator. You can't talk about the history of professional football in this country without talking about Paul Brown. So Paul Brown, it was in a league. The Browns eventually came into the NFL, but they were in a different league. Mm. And in 1946, Paul Brown brought on two black players, Marion Motley and Bill Willis, and they were two of the first four black players to reintegrate major professional football in America. Paul Brown also had a system of relaying plays into the game with guards, offensive linemen. They were called messenger guards. And he had a prominent black guard who was involved with relaying the plays into the game. And because of that, all of a sudden, black offensive linemen Well, now they were looked at a little differently, because if Paul Brown would use a black offensive lineman to be one of his quote-unquote messenger guards, well, maybe black players were a little smarter than a lot of people thought at the time.
We're talking with Jason Reed about his terrific new book, Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America. I think one of the most powerful chapters in the book is one entitled The Thinking Positions, and John Wooten is such a compelling character in your book here. He says it's quite simply that ownership and coaches, too, didn't think that we were smart enough to play what were known as those thinking positions.
Yeah, the up-the-middle positions, the center on the offensive line. That's the center is, you know, the quarterback of the offensive line, because he has to make the line adjustment call, or at least he helps in that. Middle linebacker. Middle linebacker traditionally makes the defensive play calls. He's the quarterback of the defense. And you know, John Wooten, and I'm glad you brought John's name up. John was one of those messenger guards who relayed the plays into the quarterback that Paul Brown wanted to run. So, yeah, the feeling just was that black men were not smart enough, capable enough, talented enough to play those up-the-middle positions around which everything else revolved. So, yeah, it's just flat-out racism.
Well, if he wasn't a real character in football history, someone would have to make him up because it's such a great name. Can you talk a little bit about pioneer Willie Thrower?
Yeah, Willie Thrower, I love it. The greatest quarterback name ever, Willie Thrower. You know, he plays at Michigan State. He's a backup there. He gets onto the Bears roster. This is when George Papa Bear Hallis, the founding owners of the NFL, was running the team on a day-to-day basis as a coach. The starting quarterback was having a bad game, apparently, and what we've learned from history, what we can glean from that is that we don't know exactly what George Hallis was thinking was, but we can glean that he just probably figured he'd throw Willie Thrower in there for and see what could happen for a couple of plays. Well, Willie Thrower actually, you know, gets in the game. He's the first black quarterback to get into the game in the NFL, and he actually, you know, has a couple of moments, you know, completes some passes, but he never gets another opportunity, and then he's out of the NFL shortly thereafter. And this is in the 1950s when black men were just not allowed to play quarterback.
One of the pioneers, too, passed away just recently. Can you talk a bit about Marlon Briscoe?
Yeah, Marlon Briscoe. You know, very sad about his passing. Marlon gave me a lot of time for the book. And, you know, he was the first black quarterback of the modern era. He played for the Denver Broncos when they were in the old AFL before the Broncos came to the NFL. And, you know, Marlon is not a big guy. He wasn't a big guy in terms of, you know, the prototypical quarterback size. Marlon was like 5'9", 175, 177 pounds, something like that. And he was a great quarterback at the University of Omaha, Nebraska. And back in the late 60s, black men were not drafted to play quarterback. The understanding was if the league was going to draft you, you would have to change positions. Mm. And sure enough, the Denver Broncos drafted Marlon to play cornerback. But he, you know, in a twist, he tells them, I'm not going to sign unless you give me a tryout at quarterback. They give him a tryout, but the thing was rigged. They were never going to give him a job. Well, wouldn't you know it, the starter gets hurt. Other players are affected. The team's having a horrible year, so they throw him out there. He has a great season, sets the Broncos' rookie record 14 touchdown passes, finishes high in the AFL Rookie of the Year voting, and they just simply take the job away from him because he's black. I know when people hear something like that, well, no, there have to be other reasons people think. Not in 1968. They simply took the job because they didn't want a black man to play quarterback moving forward.
And those barriers did not go away for a while. Well into the 1970s, and one of the people affected by it was the great coach Tony Dungy, who had been an outstanding quarterback at the University of Minnesota but didn't get that opportunity in the NFL.
Yeah, Tony Dungy goes to the NFL. And he's a defensive back for the Pittsburgh Steelers, and then goes on after that to have a great coaching career, obviously. But, yeah, you know, they just – that it's not to say that every black man who played quarterback in college would have definitely made it to the NFL as a quarterback and been a successful quarterback. But the thing was, the practice was that black players were just not allowed to play the position at that point. I mean, in the 60s, 70s, even into the early 80s, it's really not until the late 1980s, early 1990s, when you start to see black quarterbacks become not an oddity anymore.
And one of the quarterbacks who certainly proved that black quarterbacks could win was James Harris.
Oh, James Shaq Harris. You know, James gave me a lot of time for the book, and I'm so appreciative. He's also been a great person for me to talk to through the years. First black quarterback to start in a playoff game. First black quarterback to start a season opener. Made the Pro Bowl. James was one of those pioneers, and it's interesting. Doug Williams, who was like James Harrison's little brother, they both played at Grambling University under the legendary Eddie Robinson. At Grambling is a historically black college and university, and Doug always tells me that, you know, people talk to him about being a pioneer because Doug Williams was the first black quarterback to win a Super Bowl and the game's MVP award. But he always tells me James Shaq Harris is the pioneer because Doug Williams will tell you he stood on James Shaq Harris's shoulders.
Now, when it comes to the rise of black quarterbacks, did the situation involving Colin Kaepernick set things back a little bit?
Well, no, I wouldn't say it set things back because the league, even when Colin Kaepernick took his decided to draw attention to systemic oppression and police brutality by kneeling, even by that point, things had changed to the point where teams could no longer just exclude black men from playing the quarterback because the money got so big in the NFL and the pressure to win on general managers and coaches got so big that they could not just say, we're not going to take black quarterbacks. And not all black quarterbacks decided to kneel during the national anthem, obviously, to shine a light on these things. So the Kaepernick situation, it didn't cast a shadow over all black quarterbacks, but it did put Colin Kaepernick in a position where it cost him his career because he decided to stand on principle.
And, of course, the irony is that it was only in recent years that players even came out of the locker room for the national anthem, and only then because of an agreement with the NFL and the Defense Department that paid the league millions of dollars to use it as a promotional tool.
Yeah, you know, I always find it interesting when people want to say that, you know, the politics and, you know, issues about government and propaganda don't have a place in sports. They've always been. It's what you choose to see. Now, you know, the situation you brought up, you're 100% correct in that. But many people want sports to be escapism, and I totally get that. But what you have in the NFL with the relationship with the military and the government, like, these are things that have been present, and all Kaepernick did was shine a light on something else.
And as you point out in the book, for Donald Trump, those protests were a gift.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, when you talk about what the former president wanted to do in terms of, you know, those cultural war issues, he obviously seized on that, and he also angered many players in the NBA and the NFL, and brought them together. So yeah, it was an issue that he definitely used to unite his supporters, but it also united people who were opposed to him as well.
Jason, do you think that NFL fans are perhaps as a group more inclined to buy into some of the old stereotypes?
Well, you know, with the Colin Kaepernick situation, I'm going to answer it in kind of the same way that I would with that. I think it largely falls along racial lines. Polling during the Kaepernick situation, when he was ignited the protest movement in the NFL, it largely fell along racial lines. And generally speaking, black people supported what he was doing, and generally speaking, white people did not. So I think that they're, you know, black people are NFL fans too, and a lot of times in this discussion, when we talk about NFL fans, the tendency is to only frame it from the position of generally speaking white NFL fans. So again, I think it falls largely along racial lines.
You say quite simply that Patrick Mahomes is the best black quarterback in NFL history, but at some point we may just say best quarterback in NFL history. How has he changed the perception of black QBs?
Well, what Patrick Mahomes has done, and what he is, he represents everything the pioneers thought could one day be achieved by a black quarterback. Because what Doug Williams and James Shaq Harris and Warren Moon will tell you, and which they told me for the book, is that they always thought that if black quarterbacks had an opportunity to just compete for the position, one of them one day would rise up to be the best quarterback in the NFL. And there was a 2-year stretch there, 2018, 2019, where Patrick Mahomes was unquestionably the number one player in the league. He won the NFL MVP award as a first-year starter after the 2018 season. He won the Super Bowl trophy and the Super Bowl MVP award after the 2019 season. And right now, he's either the best quarterback or the second-best quarterback or the third. He's definitely in the top three or four quarterbacks right now. But back then, for those 2 years, he was unquestionably the best quarterback in the league, regardless of race. And the platform that he had and the influence that he had, he pushed the league forward on these social justice matters because it was important to him.
We have a lot of black quarterbacks these days, but as you point out in the epilogue to the book, still very few black coaches out there. The whole Brian Flores situation remains to be seen. What comes of that? What's the future for black coaches and black executives in the league?
Well, that's the next frontier. You know, the black quarterbacks, for a very long time, that was the frontier for black people to prove within the league that the black man could thrive as a quarterback at the most important position in the NFL, most important position in team sports. The next frontier is for more black coaches to become in positions of influence in the league, to become head coaches, more black executives to rise up to the level of general manager, and for those people to win, and win in a manner where it's no longer questioned that those executives and those coaches belong at the top of the game.
So the subtitle of your book is What It Means for America. So I'll ask you, what does the rise of the black quarterback mean?
Well, quarterback is a uniquely American leadership position. When you, in corporate America, the person leading a big project for a company, he's the quarterback of the project. If you're going for a medical procedure, your doctor is the quarterback. He's the one who has to get you through this big thing. So as we see black men being excluded from the quarterback position in the NFL, it says something in a very offensive manner about the ability of black men and black people to achieve excellence. So now that we have the rise of the black quarterback, we see that also coincides with the rise of black people in America in the last century and this century. You have a black president. We've had a black president. We've had black captains of industry. We've had black people in many walks of life rise to positions that, you know, 30, 40 years ago, they would not have even been able to attempt to occupy. So the rise of the black quarterback coincides with the rise of black people in America. And foremost, what it shows is that when people are given opportunities, when people of color are given opportunities, not everyone will succeed, but enough will succeed to show that, hey, opportunity was all that was required.
Well, it's a tremendously well-researched and thought-provoking book, Rise of the Black Quarterback, What It Means for America. Jason, thank you so much for making time for us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.